From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Rio de Janeiro, the world capital of Carnival, certainly knows how to throw a party. So there's good reason to expect that the opening ceremony of the 2016 Olympics this Friday will be quite a show. But these Olympics are swamped in controversy, from fears of Zika to polluted waters to doping scandals to concerns about crime and security. Still, there will be games with amazing athletes competing against amazing athletes. This hour on Point, the 2016 Rio Olympic Games. You can join us on air or online. Are you enthusiastic for the competition in Brazil? Are you expecting chaos, or do you think the doom and gloom coverage is overblown? Which athletes are most excited about? Do you tend to cheer for countries or individual athletes? Do you root for Goliath to go down or the up-and-comer to catch a break? And in these tumultuous worldwide times, do you see the games as just what we need as a uniter of nations? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us first from São Paulo, Brazil, is Samantha Pearson, a Brazil reporter for the Financial Times. Samantha, thanks for joining us, and welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Could you give us at first a little sense of when these games were announced that they would be played in Rio so many years ago? At the time, Brazil was really sort of a country and economy ascendant. I mean, things were looking really positive. Things had changed in the past few years. Give us a sense of the political economic change there.
Exactly. So the scenario here has really changed dramatically. It's almost a different country we're seeing now. So in 2009, when Brazil won the right to host the Olympics, Brazil was growing, about 7.5%. People even said maybe Brazil's going to be the next United States of America. People were that optimistic about the country's prospects. And Brazilians in general were very excited when they won the bid. There was a huge party on Copacabana Beach in Rio. And it was a moment of kind of joy and of national pride. Completely different scenario now, 2016. Brazil's facing its worst, longest and deepest recession on record. We're facing probably the kind of most acute political crisis in living memory, at least. And there's a lot of negativity about the Olympics. I mean, to a certain extent, I think that's normal. In London, we saw the same thing. British people were very kind of negative about the games before they happened. But in Brazil, I think that's even more the case. There was a poll recently showing that 50% of Brazilians now actually oppose staging the Olympics.
Fully half of the country.
Exactly, and that's double the number that were recorded in 2013, only 3 years ago. So really, those kind of negative feelings have increased dramatically over the past couple of years.
And Samantha, as you just said, in many ways, it's sort of the sky is falling tends to be part of the build-up to the Olympics. I mean, before the competition begins, you can't talk about the competition, so the media tends to talk about what's wrong. But it does seem like there's an unprecedented number of things happening. Just as an example, I want to play a piece of sound that deals with the bay, Guanabara Bay in Brazil, in Rio. This is German Olympic sailor Annika Lorenz talking to CNN's Ivan Watson about training and competing in the polluted waters of that bay.
You've hit garbage out here?
Yes. Yeah.
What kind of garbage? What are you hitting?
A lot of plastic bags, but training partners of us also hit a chair or some wood.
Furniture?
Yes.
And Samantha, we've heard that some of the swimmers are going to be told they will wear special suits sort of to fight against bacteria. Some sailors have been told, don't open your mouth and let water in. Give us a sense of how serious the pollution or environmental issue is.
Yeah, I would say that's actually probably one of the biggest problems facing the Rio 2016 Games. So Guanabara Bay, as you said, which is Rio's main bay, and where sailing and windsurfing events will be held. It's severely polluted. And the state government in Rio had promised to clean up the waters, but that didn't happen largely because the state government ran out of money. I mean, they're on the verge of bankruptcy. Also, Ike Batista, who used to be Brazil's richest man, he lived in Rio and he promised to help fund the cleanup. But then in 2013, as you probably remember, his commodities empire went bankrupt. He was since charged for or accused of insider trading. So the cleanup they have done a few things, but the cleanup never really happened. So you've got this kind of toxic, disgusting mix of raw sewage, industrial waste, random things like washing machines, sofas, and they've even found, dead dogs and even dead people, corpses. So it's pretty horrific, really.
But the athletes are preparing to compete in those waters anyway. They're using equipment and suits.
Exactly. If you think about the type of person that becomes an Olympic athlete, you know, these aren't people that are scared off by sewers, I imagine. And, you know, these are strong, you know, kind of tough-willed people. But I think it's actually, I mean, we've kind of made that point, but I think it's worth also saying that the Olympics itself, you know, as an event, as a spectacle, I actually think will probably be okay, you know, barring any major terrorist attack. I think it's probably going to be considered, you know, a success by some measures, much the same way that the World Cup was in 2014. There's a lot of negativity before that was held in Brazil, and actually when the event got going, Brazilians changed their mind quite rapidly, and it was seen as a success in terms of the event itself. But, you know, as you said, the number of problems in the preparation, in the lead-up to the Rio Olympics has been, you know, it's been mind-boggling. It's almost like seeing, you know, kind of a horror film unfold here.
We are going to hear from an athlete later in the show who really believes that we need to focus less on what's wrong and more on how hard these athletes have trained. But I do think it's important to run through some of the problems that could potentially interfere with some of the athletes in their training. And one example is, are the venues ready? Is the infrastructure ready? Just last week, the head of the Australian Olympic team said that her athletes would be staying in a hotel until problems in the Olympic Village housing were fixed.
The decision we have taken is out of care for all our athletes. We have 6 coming in tomorrow and about 50 athletes coming in on Tuesday. In our mind, our building is not habitable and not conducive to the performance-focused environment that we are trying to create for our Australian team.
Samantha Pearson, from your view in Brazil, how ready is Rio for the Games? Will things be ready in a few days?
Well, the venues themselves are actually ready. That's probably the most positive thing about the Rio's preparation for the Games. But the Olympic Village is, you know, it's so many problems there. Many delegations, not only the Australians, have refused to move in. There's been problems with plumbing, exposed wires, general kind of dirty conditions. Last week, the Olympic organizers had to hire 600 workers to work, you know, 24 hours a day just to carry out last-minute maintenance. But the Australians have had a particular tough time, actually, over the weekend. There are some people staying there now, and there was a fire in the basement. And when they were evacuated, some people went in and stole their laptops.
Oh, that's terrible. So that's terrible.
They've had a tough time. And also, I don't know if you remember, an Australian Paralympic athlete, he was also mugged at gunpoint recently in Rio. And that's another big problem, you know, not only the kind of infrastructure, but also the question of violence. We had human body parts washing up on Copacabana Beach a while back. An Australian television team was also attacked. And then you've got the huge threat of terrorism, which is not only obviously Brazil, but it's a real threat.
Right. It's security at both ends, both street crime and global terrorism. Do you have a sense how ready Brazil is for that possibility?
Brazilians really don't take terrorism that seriously for a reason. You know, nothing has ever really happened here. They've kind of beefed up their efforts recently. There was the first kind of ever terrorist operation in Brazil last month when they arrested 12 men suspected of having links to ISIS. So they are doing things now. The Brazilians themselves and the government themselves have said actually street crime is probably the biggest threat, and that seems to be the case. Probably not the actual drug gangs that kind of operate in the favelas, because you know, this is a peak time for them as well in terms of selling cocaine, and they don't actually want to, you know, anything to get in the way of their business as such. But when we're talking about kind of normal street crime, I think that's probably going to be the main problem, really.
Samantha,
we've already seen a few incidences.
One of our listeners on Facebook, Michael Russell, wrote in and had this comment. He said, wouldn't all the money spent on these games have been better used to improve the lives of millions of Brazilians living in poverty? And this is a question that gets asked with every Olympics when billions are spent for venues that will be used for 2 weeks. What's your sense from talking to people in Rio and elsewhere in the country about whether ultimately, despite the grumbling now, they feel like there will be benefit and the infrastructure improvements for the Olympics will help them long term? For example, I think a subway was just completed that, of course, will be there long after the games. People feeling like there will be benefit that have made this worthwhile?
There are some benefits. You mentioned the subway. There's also a kind of bus express lane that's very popular among poorer Brazilians. There's a light railway system that they've built, which is going to connect the port area to the airport. These are important legacies. It's also worth pointing out that a lot of the money that actually went into the games wasn't government money. It was from the private sector, kind of private-public partnerships. But as I said, Brazilians are, it's hard to explain that to someone who's living in a favela in Rio, and they have to use the public hospitals in the city, which are completely broke. They're running out of basic materials, bandages, medication. It's hard to kind of explain that to one of these Brazilians and say, oh, but look, you've got a bus lane, So,
right. And in fact, some of the neighborhoods were removed to make way for some of the venues, I understand.
Exactly. So in Barra, which is where most of the Olympic venues are, there was a favela there, and that's basically being demolished. There were a lot of protests, but that didn't really make much difference. And also, one thing that doesn't get mentioned enough, I think, in the press is there was a favela project called Molac Carioca, which was the government's promise to the Olympic Committee that they were going to help sort out the favelas before the Olympics. And that program still exists on paper, but in practice, nothing's really happening. Yeah. And so they've been forgotten once again, really.
So I think it will take till the end of the games for the scorecard to really be tallied in terms of who benefited and if it was worth it. So Samantha Pearson reports from Brazil for the Financial Times. Thank you very much for that update from São Paulo. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. With the opening ceremony of the Rio Olympics just 4 days away, we're looking ahead to the athletes, the games, and the controversies around the games. You can join the conversation. Do you know anybody who was going down to see the games? Did you consider it, but did Zika scare you off? Is it right that so many Russian athletes have been banned from the games for doping? And I want to bring two great sports writers into this conversation. Joining me from Miami is Michelle Kaufman. She covers sports for the Miami Herald, and she's heading to Rio Wednesday to cover her 14th Olympic Games. That is a long track record. Michelle, it's good to have you.
Great to be here.
And joining us from New York is Matthew Futterman. He's a senior special writer on sports for the Wall Street Journal and author of Players, the Story of Sports and Money and the Visionaries Who Fought to Create the Revolution. Matthew, thanks to you too for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Michelle, again, considering that this is your 14th Games, could you give us your sense of, you're used to this buildup in which we hear these concerns about security and will the buildings be ready and is the pollution. How does Rio compare to other Olympics you have covered where there was also concern in the lead up to the kickoff?
Yeah, I mean, there have been these kind of stories almost every Olympics that I've covered. I mean, if you go back to Athens 2004, it was the first summer games after 9/11. And they flew us, the Miami Herald and Knight Ridder at that time, flew all the reporters to Washington, D.C. for an 8-hour terrorism training course. They issued us gas masks. They showed us very scary videos and, told us what to do if your arm gets blown off, if your leg gets blown off. And we went there, my husband and I were both covering it. We took our 4-year-old daughter, and we had our gas masks, and we were very worried. And I'm telling you, within 2 days that we were there, my husband turned to me and said, we're not going to carry these gas masks around anymore. This is ridiculous. We were in a beautiful city with people that were really excited about the games. Nothing happened. Before Beijing, there was a lot of talk about the smog. There was the SARS virus before the World Cup, and I cover World Cup also. World Cup soccer in South Africa, there were huge concerns about crime, huge concerns about nothing being ready, the stadiums won't be ready. Then the World Cup again in Brazil 2 years ago, which I also covered. I was there for 5 weeks in Brazil. The London Olympics, there was a lot of, stress about terrorism mainly. And then Sochi, 2014, when we talk about the athletes' village not being ready, I can tell you that when I went to check into the media village in Sochi, and when they told me your room isn't ready, they didn't mean that the maid was cleaning it. They meant that the room was not constructed yet. And I literally waited 6 hours while they were literally hanging the door on the room. They were putting the shower head in and they were installing the toilet on the day that I was checking in.
So I remember those sad but hilarious pictures that reporters were sending as they showed up where they were supposed to sleep, and they were finding, you know, wires and pipes dangling out of walls. But in the end, I mean, most things worked out.
There are always wires and pipes, yeah. And there are always wires sticking out and things aren't always quite ready. Usually you see where they were going to do landscaping and the landscaping never gets put in, or you see the plants on the side still sitting in the little containers and you know that, you know, they intended to put those in the ground. So these kind of things always happen. I do think that a lot of the coverage is overblown. But in this case, the main, I do believe the water pollution, in my mind, is the biggest concern. I mean, crime, the Zika is really not, because it's the middle of the winter there. In fact, the bigger Zika outbreak is right here in Miami. I'm going to get the heck out of Miami to get out of the Zika zone, to be honest, because there's more Zika. There were two people found with Zika mosquito bites just yesterday in Wynwood, which is a really cool artsy part of Miami. So that I'm not worried about. Crime, there's crime in Miami too. But the polluted water, if I were an athlete who had to compete in that particular bay, I don't think for any of the other athletes, I think everything will be fine. I do think that the sailing, if you have to be told don't open your mouth when you're in a water sport, that's definitely a concern. So that's the biggest thing, the biggest concern that I see. And then, yeah, there will be street crime. But I was in Brazil 2 years ago, and I know things have changed. The economy's gotten worse, and they say it's worse now than 2 years ago. But for the most part, I felt fine in Brazil for 5 weeks. I have one colleague who had her cell phone stolen, but she was texting in public out on the street, which they told us not to do, and she regretted it. So I think in the end, what's going to happen is that we're all going to get to Brazil at some point this week. People will then start writing scene stories. And then on Friday, we're very predictable in the media, as you know. You know, we write all the negative stuff. Then we get there and we write the scene stories about the samba dancers on the street and the women in bikinis and drinking caipirinha. And then Friday will be the opening ceremony. And then at that point, I really do believe, and I mean, I hope I'm right, after 13 Olympics, I hope this is the same, that all of the focus will then turn to the athletics and the competition. And the only controversy there will be if somebody, you know, if a Russian athlete wins a medal and someone else finishes fourth, there may be some controversy about people thinking that, you know, some Russian doped athletes slipped through the cracks and got in. So,
but overall, a pretty optimistic outlook. That's a pretty good prediction from Michelle Kaufman,
yeah,
for how things will
overall
go.
Overall, I'm optimistic.
So Matthew Futterman of The Wall Street Journal, your take. I mean, we've got, you know, political concerns, economic concerns, health, water, facilities, street crime, some teacher strikes. What are you thinking? What are you expecting?
I guess I'm expecting a combination of things. One is, you know, this is the first time, I think, you know, there is always a fair amount of doom and gloom heading into these things, although I don't remember much of it heading into London.
Security, I think, was the big issue in
London. Security, but, you know, I live in New York, so, like,
so you understand,
you know,
that concern.
Yeah, I mean, like, security, it's kind of like the air at this point, right?
Yeah.
So it's just sort of always there. So so there was that. So, but, you know, I do think this is the first time we're sort of heading in, certainly in my memory, that we're heading into a games where there is this level of both political and economic crisis in the country and in the city that's there. You know, I was with Michelle 2 years ago at the World Cup, and then I was back in Rio last October, and it was amazing how much had changed in a year. I mean, just so many more storefronts were closed, restaurants were closed, many more people were begging on the streets. There was a real palpable sense that things had really taken a turn for the
worse. And I think that accentuates sort of the inequity we often see in the Olympics, where so much money is spent on venues and glitzing up a city, even though people say, why isn't this being spent on transportation, on infrastructure, and helping the poor? Do you feel like it's being extra magnified in Rio this year?
I think it's extra magnified in Rio, and I think it probably should be extra magnified in the rest of the sports world too. I mean, especially given the level of inequality you have, and that you have in a lot of, you know, the industrialized countries these days, and given the fact that, you know, the people who are owning or partaking in sports, and in this country at least, you know, owning professional sports teams, I mean, we still have, you still have, you know, $500 million going to NBA owners to, you know, for to build a stadium. And when those NBA owners happen to be, you know, the wealthiest of the wealthiest of the wealthy in the country. So, you know, it's I don't know that we can necessarily sit here and point our fingers and say, shame on you, Brazil, for spending money on the Olympics instead of spending money on healthcare, because, you know, we do the same thing here.
Matthew, I want to play a sound from a video produced by Vox about what Rio does not want the world to see at the Olympics. Here it is.
When you leave the international airport of Rio de Janeiro and head towards the south of the city, which is where all the beaches are, you pass a sprawling informal settlement called Mare. It's one of hundreds of neglected shanty towns like this in Rio. It goes on for miles. But when you pass by there today, all you see is this wall.
A wall presumably meant to block the public from seeing that shanty town still there. Do you think there is an element of that, that Rio is kind of wallpapering some of its issues so that people who attend will mostly just see glitz?
I mean, I think they'll try, but look, I mean, I've taken that ride from the Rio airport down, you know, into the city. I mean, wall or no wall, the traffic is so bad on that highway and it moves so slowly that there's these little kids standing in the middle of the highway selling candy bars and flowers and whatever else. And when I say standing in the middle of the highway, I mean standing in the middle of the highway. I mean, because the traffic isn't moving, but it's kind of a stunning thing to see. So, you know, if there's a wall blocking a, you know, an area that's very poor, sure, I could see them doing that, but you know, you can only block so much. Mm-hmm. It's sort of everywhere you look in Rio, unless you're in you know, some of the nice areas that are within about 5 or 6 blocks of the beach.
Matthew Futterman of the Wall Street Journal and Michelle Kaufman of the Miami Herald, stay with us. I want to bring in another voice. This is an athlete. This is Chuck Aoki. He's a U.S. wheelchair rugby player who will be competing in Rio. He was part of the team that took bronze in London in 2012. And in 2011, he was named Athlete of the Year by the U.S. Quad Rugby Association. And we wanted to bring him on the show because Chuck posted a recent blog post, and he titled it, Why I Will Go to Rio Despite What People May Think. Our listeners can find a link to that on our website at onpointradio.org. And Chuck Aoki, thank you for making time for us and coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So, Chuck, there was another athlete, Megan Calmo. She's a U.S. Olympic rower. She wrote a very impassioned and very powerful personal public letter, basically telling the country, telling the media, telling the U.S. to stop focusing on the negative and remember that athletes have trained their lives, they've trained their hearts out to do this and to focus on supporting them. And you wrote a letter that echoed that sentiment. Can you tell us, give us the message you want to get across and what it was about Megan's letter that made you decide to address this as well?
Sure. So I guess what I've kind of been thinking about as I'm recalling both hers and my thing you wrote is I think the general public is actually getting sort of a little peek on the inside into sort of Olympic and Paralympic athletes' mindsets and sort of how we think about our preparation for the games. And that preparation is really at the highest levels controlling what you can control. You know, we can control our training, we can control how hard we work, we can control, you know, the different players we work with and the places we train, but we can't control, you know, anything that's going on in Brazil. You know, we can't control where we're going to compete in Brazil. They've already decided that. We can't control, you know, what the security is going to be like. That's out of our hands. And so I think what you saw kind of interesting was this pushback that a lot of us are getting athletes-wise, and it's not just Megan and I think it's a lot of athletes, is, look, you know, all people are seeing is, you know, of course, what's being reported and all these terrible things that are going on in Brazil that are definitely unfortunate, but you're not seeing, like we said, the positive side, the amount of work and sacrifice and struggle that we're all putting into this effort. And of course, that stuff's not very interesting to cover, and I don't expect it to be. You know, going and watching me do kill sprints isn't exactly gonna move the needle for a lot of people, but you know, we see all this extra work that's going on behind the scenes as being worked to get ourselves ready for that point. And so I think you kind of just saw almost in a way some frustration pouring over and saying, look, we're working hard, we're ready to represent you, you're gonna, you know, be amazed with what you see. Just hang on a little longer.
Do you think the negativity affects the psyche of the athletes? Does it interfere with the psychological part of their training?
I think for some athletes it can. Like I said, you know, we work with sports psychologists, a lot of athletes do. And like I said, a lot of that is really trying to block out that other stuff that's out of our hands, you know. Like I can't control whether or not, you know, they end up, you know, ultimately removing their president. We can't control, you know, whether or not that's going to, those sorts of things are going to happen. So I think some athletes definitely start to get psyched in by, you know, a lot of people are like, well, what is ETA? You know, I haven't researched it. I don't know what that is. You know, I don't quite know what's going on. And so the uncertainty can definitely throw some people off. But I think ultimately when you get to the Paralympics or the Olympics, the stage is just so big. If you're going to get psyched up by something, it's the sheer magnitude of the games.
And do you think that based on what you have heard about the various concerns, this will be a more challenging Olympics for athletes to compete in for whatever reason, the water, the concern about health, the facilities possibly not being ready, some of the economic political turmoil going on?
You know, it's hard to say. I would think that it may be. You know, I was in London as well, as you mentioned. And so, like you were saying, there were some concerns. And, of course, we got to London and everything was fine. And so my personal feeling is that Rio will ultimately be very similar. You know, we spend most of our time in the village. We travel out, you know, very limited amounts. And so I would tend to be somewhat insulated from what's going on around us. So I would say, I think unless there's a major sort of event that happens in some capacity, I don't know that it'll be any more distracting than anything in London was.
One of the other big issues is this massive doping scandal. And, of course, doping has been an issue in so many of the games for so long. But this is one that involves a state-sponsored, systemic sort of effort to dope and then cover up for doping of Russian athletes. So that's a big deal. Now, it's unclear at this point which Russian athletes will be able to compete because those decisions are still being made by various Olympic committees and federations. But one of the issues because of that is that some athletes don't know who their competitors will be. Can you give us your sense, Chuck, of when you go into games like this, to what degree do you tailor your training in terms of who you think you'll be competing against? And is not knowing who your competitor will be a disadvantage?
It absolutely would be. For us, you know, wheelchair rugby, we're a team sport. So we very much prepare to play against specific teams that have specific players who we know their strengths and weaknesses of. And compare for it. So if you were to tell me, you know, right now, oh, you know, the Canadian national team might not have one of their top players, or, you know, or Australia could lose two players, you'd be like, well, what are we supposed to do with that? You know, that is sort of the unknown that's not being talked about. I think that you're referencing really well there is that, yeah, it is definitely distracting because when you're preparing to train, you do prepare for your teams. Obviously, your main focus is yourself and your own personal training and getting yourself to a point. But particularly for any sort of sport where you're competing directly against somebody and there is that sort of strategy going on of, okay, how do I want to race this person or how do I want to best make sure I'm able to counter what they do effectively? It is a huge deal to not know who you're competing against. And sort of having this uncertainty this close to the games has got to be frustrating for a lot of athletes.
Vladimir Putin himself has weighed in on this. He's challenging the decision to exclude more than 100 athletes from them. And here is a little sound from him in June translated by Euronews.
Of course it's not fair. There are common acceptable principles of rights, one of which is that responsibility should be personalized.
Chuck Aoki, do you feel like you can speak for yourself or for other athletes in terms of whether people think how Russia is being treated is fair this Olympics?
Oh, fairness is a tough word to use. well, you know, I think that it's not fair, but it's not fair for either side. I think that the timing of this is, of course, extremely unfortunate for both Russia and for the athletes. But, you know, the goal, you know, the ultimate goal is to make sure everyone's competing clean. And while it's a tough balance, is it more fair to say, okay, a couple clean athletes are getting booted for the majority being doped? Or is this a few dopers who are then getting all these other clean athletes in trouble? It certainly sounds like it's the first one. It certainly seems like there's a lot more people who are doping as opposed to not doping. Of course, it's really hard to tell. It's just really disappointing. You know, at the Olympics, Paralympics are supposed to be about the integrity of sport, about the spirit of sport, about the sort of honor and commitment and passion to go along with it. And it really is too bad because that's being called into question. You know, it's being called into question athletes' integrity. And that's something that we should be able to take for granted. And when you're not able to take it for granted, you know, it really starts to kind of question the whole system. And I'm hoping that while they'll resolve this issue, and we can move forward and really just focus on the athletes and their incredible performances.
That's Chuck Aoki. He's part of the U.S. wheelchair rugby team. He'll be competing in Rio. You can watch him play from September 14th to 18th. Chuck, thanks so much for your time.
Absolutely.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. The Rio Olympics, after months of sky is falling coverage about this year's games, kick off this Friday. Give us a call and let us know what events you plan to watch, which athletes you care about. My guests are Michelle Kaufman, a sports writer for the Miami Herald, and Matthew Futterman, a special writer on sports for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to both of you. And Michelle, I wonder if you would weigh in on something that we just heard athlete Chuck Aoki talking about, which is how it can sort of mess with your head when you're not sure who your competitor is going to be. I mean, for those of us who aren't professional athletes, we may think you just go out and do what you're good at, no matter who you're playing against. But give us your sense of when there is an uncertainty about your competitor, how does that affect your preparation and your psychology to compete?
Yeah, absolutely. Athletes always say that they focus on themselves, and coaches always say that too. I have to focus on my own performance, and it doesn't matter about the competition. I have to do, you know, play my game, play my style, do whatever. But yeah, they definitely all have rivals. These athletes, even though most of the world only watches them compete every 4 years, they're competing against a lot of these same people all the time in world championships every year, in big international meets and tournaments. So they know exactly who their competition is, which athletes they have to be the most worried about. And, you know, I definitely think that it could affect your psyche, because if you know for a fact that someone that was your biggest competition all of a sudden has been thrown out and is not going to compete, you know, that would affect you. And if you don't know and you're wondering, I wonder if that person's going to compete or not. But, you know, at the end of the day, I do think that they do, most of them focus on themselves. Simone Biles, the gymnast, she's focusing on her own routines and perfecting what she does. And Katie Ledecky, the swimmer, you know, it doesn't matter who's in the pool with her. She has to really focus on what she's doing. So I do think where it's going to come into play, which I mentioned before, is the fourth place finisher in an event where a Russian wins a medal. I think there could be some drama and some criticism, and some athletes may come out and speak out at that point. If you finish fourth, you've trained your whole life or 8 years or 4 years for this one moment, and you get edged out by a Russian athlete, and there's a question if that athlete has been part of the state-run doping system, that'll be very, very, very extra disappointing for that fourth-place finisher. So that's where I see that it could become a storyline as the games get going.
Let's go to a caller who wants to weigh in on doping, and this is Michael Botticelli. He's calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks for calling in. What do you think about the doping aspect of this year's games?
Oh my! It's stealing. It's criminal. It should be felonious. When you come in fourth, you are considered almost an also ran. You've trained as hard as everybody else, and the point about training, even the team sports, what you have to do to win is you have to do what the winner does. You have to do more of it, and you have to do it better. And that's just as simple as it gets, or faster, or stronger. And you do. I mean, the point that she made was great, that you know who you're training against, and if the top one's out, then it makes it not any easier. But
and Michael, I should interject. You have Olympic ties, so you really speak from very personal and professional experience here.
Absolutely. I was at 80 Olympics, and we had our little faux pas was that Russia was in Afghanistan, and we were boycotting the next summer games, so Russia was quarantined to the village. And the rest of the athletes kind of voluntarily stayed in the village also. We wanted things. We were the last all-amateur Olympics. We were the last communist country Olympics. Everything after that kind of changed, and it was paradigm shifting. But it's tough when we had Ty Babylonian Randy Gardner had to withdraw just before the event because of injuries. And that happens like the second before. You're talking about training. We were to skate after them, and we would have had 7 or 8 minutes if they had skated, and losing that 7, 8 minutes doesn't seem like much, but you've trained for 8, 10, 12 years to peak at that second, that moment, that time that you have to go out. And that kind of really takes it away. But kind of back to the doping, you guys ran a story on NPR about an American that came in fourth, and then two of the Russians in first and third took out. Boy, that changes her life. That changes her life. You don't have a whole lot of stories out there about the guy that was fifth at Olympics. The guy that was third isn't holding up a Snickers bar. It's the guy that's first and second. And first, second, and third. It's medals. And if you had a Russian up there right now, I would be screaming bloody murder, because it was state sponsored. It was like we're suing Volkswagen billions and billions and billions of dollars because they attempted fraud, they succeeded fraud, then they got caught. Now they're caught. I mean, nobody, every one of those Volkswagens is being taken back. Not some of them, not the ones that people like. All of the Russians should be gone because it was state-sponsored. The ones that knew should have been looking for asylum someplace else or dual citizenship someplace else if they were the true athletes, the true Olympic athletes that we all try and hope to be. But the Olympics has, the luster is gone. We're late here. 3 years ago, we should have been wondering why the second, third, and fourth water treatment plants should have, but it wasn't sexy then. It wasn't in the news then. Nobody wants to talk about something that's 3 years ahead. We all get lazy.
Michael, thank you for that. I should note, I know this from my producer's notes from them having chatted with you beforehand. Michael Botticelli of Whelan was the captain of the U.S. Olympic team for figure skating in 1980. So again, speaks very much from experience. I want to go to a caller also from Worcester, Ohio. This is Sarah calling from Worcester. And Sarah, you have a specific team or athlete you're watching, plan to watch?
Yeah, I'm really excited about watching the U.S. women's indoor volleyball team. They have been in the top two in the world for the last couple of years, and it's going to be a great showdown between USA and Brazil. Fantastic athletes, fantastic coaching, and a lot of women who've been working really, really hard for the last 4 years.
And do you feel that there has been a negativity of coverage, and are you feeling like we need to start to get behind our athletes and cheer them on?
I think anytime, you know, when the Olympics come around, we get a chance to really showcase some of our team sports that we don't always see. But those of us in the volleyball community, we've been supporting them, and we're excited that, you know, we really have a shot for a gold medal in indoor volleyball.
Sarah, thanks for calling. Matthew Futterman of The Wall Street Journal, give us an overview of who you're looking at. Who do you think are the sort of must-watch athletes this time?
Well, this is not exactly a news-breaking thing, but I think the Usain Bolt is the only Olympic athlete I've ever seen that when he walks into a stadium, and those are big stadiums, about 80,000 people, every eye in the stadium goes to him. I mean, there can be hundreds of people on the track. And
Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt.
Yeah, Jamaican sprinter. And he's going for the triple-triple, which would be the 100, 200, and the 4x100 relay for a third time in a row, which has never been done. And that's, I think, going to be just about the biggest highlight of the game.
And Matthew, I think it was you that wrote this wonderful story recently about sort of the physics of Usain Bolt's speed and body and about how he has this stride length. He can take very long strides, so he covers more ground, and also quick steps, so he has the advantage of speed and stride. And you had this great line where you said that Usain Bolt seems to have another gear that no one else does. That's a really great way to sum up just how much speed this guy has.
Right. I mean, the amazing thing is when you listen to people who have raced against him, they describe this thing of, you know, he's right next to you at one moment, and then all of a sudden he's just going away, and you don't know where he went. I mean, you can know where he went. He went ahead of you much more quickly than you did. But what's interesting is it's kind of an optical illusion. It's not that he is going so much faster at that point. It's actually that he's slowing down slower than you are, because people can't sprint, can't reach their top speed after about 70 meters, and from there they kind of slow down. And so because his legs are longer, but he turns his legs over as quickly as anybody else does, he's been virtually impossible to beat.
Michelle Kaufman of the Miami Herald, you mentioned earlier Simone Biles, this this American female gymnast. And what I find really interesting about her is that because the way that gymnasts are scored has changed, there's no longer the perfect 10, but you sort of gain points depending on difficulty and complexity. She does these very complicated routines that tend to earn her points, even if she might stumble once in a while, just because they are so much more complicated than other gymnast routines. So tell us a little bit about her and what you think about her and should we be watching her?
Oh, absolutely. Mary Lou Retton has already said, you know, the 1984 champion, that Simone Biles is the best gymnast she's ever seen. A lot of the commentators have been saying that over the last year, that there has never been in the world ever. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember, you know, Olga Korbut and Nadia and Mary Lou and all these gymnasts. A lot of people are saying there has never been a better gymnast than this young woman, Simone Biles. She's 19 years old. She's tiny. She's 4'9", she's so powerful. And the difficulty that you were talking about, the stuff that she does, no one even attempts what she's doing. So she's getting extra points, just like in figure skating and the other judge sports, diving. The level of difficulty of your list of tricks is comes into play, and for her, she not only tries and attempts all those things, she almost always lands them. She's won 3 world championships in a row, and she's by far the biggest favorite, and there is more pressure on her, and that will be really the only question. There is no question she's the best gymnast in the world. There's no question the difficulty of the stuff. When you watch her floor routine, you can't even believe it's a human doing some of the stuff she does. But the question, the only question is, will she stand up to the pressure? Because when you come into the games at 19 years old, it's her first Olympics, and everyone is saying, you're the best gymnast in the world. You're definitely going to win it, you know, 1 gold for sure, probably 4. People are saying she's going to win 4 gold medals, you know, 3-4 golds between the individual events, the team, and the all around. That's a huge amount of pressure. So the question is, can she land all of those really difficult, daring tricks when the biggest, hottest spotlight is on her?
Well, we actually have a piece of sound of her weighing in on how she thinks about competition and deals with pressure. Here she is speaking in June.
I know what, like, I can take and what I can't take, but most of the time you just focus on the positives and you don't think about the pressure, because then that, it, like, makes you nervous. And, I mean, nobody really wants to be nervous or, like, be stressed out, so we just don't think about it.
And that is a reminder that being a top athlete not only involves physical excellence, but mental stamina. You know, how do you deal with pressure? Matthew Futterman, would you weigh in a bit on Michael Phelps? Of course, the most decorated, I believe, Olympian ever, but certainly had some personal crises in recent years. Maybe not surprising given how young he was and how much success he had. He had 2 DUIs in recent years, but it looks like this is kind of a redemption moment for him. Tell us about Michael Phelps.
Well, he is coming back. He did retire 4 years ago, and he was, you know, said he was completely done with this sport, which was completely understandable, because I think a lot of people don't realize just what drudgery swimming training is. I mean, it's staring at a black line and your head underwater for just hours and hours on end. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. So he took a couple years off, really didn't find anything else to do with himself, and came back to the pool, has come back to the pool to try and sort of write another chapter, because the last time anyone heard about him, he was going for alcohol treatment, and that was after getting arrested for DUI. And it looks like he should do pretty well. I think he's in the mix for probably 4 medals, and I think the big question is just what color they're going to be. His, you know, signature race has always been the 200 butterfly. He's got some pretty intense competition from Laszlo Che of Hungary and Chad Lacoste of South Africa. Those are going to be some pretty serious battles in that stroke. And he's also swimming the 200 IM, and he is going to probably be swimming the medley relay as well.
And also an excellent female U.S. swimmer, Katie Ledecky. Am I saying her last name correctly?
Ledecky. Katie Ledecky. Yeah, she's going to be the big star. I mean, so Simone Biles is terrific. She does a much riskier sport. I mean, you know, I don't expect her to do this, but she could go on one of her crazy tumble things and, you know, land on her head, God forbid, and then she doesn't win anything. You know, swimming is not a ton of injuries in swimming. If there's one person that can sort of go down to Rio and just sort of pick up a medal and they probably don't really have to do the race, it would be Katie Ledecky in the 800, where no one can touch her. I think she's about 7 or 12 seconds faster than the closest competition, about half the pool.
There's another set of athletes, another team that is probably less known and not getting as much attention. And this deals with this incredible immigration crisis that the world is facing. There is a refugee team this year. This is the first ever independent Olympic team of refugees. And this is 17-year-old Yusra Mardini. He fled Syria last year, and in this Olympics, he will be swimming for Team Refugee.
In the water, there is no difference if you're a refugee or Syrian or German. I think in the water is just the water, you and your competing mate.
Michelle Kaufman of the Miami Herald, is that sort of the spirit of the Olympics? I mean, with all the concerns and the doom we talked about in the first part of the show, is that really distill us to what matters most, physical excellence, the chance to compete at the highest level?
Oh, absolutely. I think, I mean, one of the reasons I love covering the Olympics and that I keep, it doesn't matter how many I've done, I never get tired of it. I'm a complete sap at the opening ceremonies. I admit it. I cry, when I hear the Olympic anthem and when the Parade of Nations. I mean, I don't get jaded as the way I do with professional American sports. And yes, I know there's cheating, and yes, I know that it's big money now, and there's big sponsors, and it's very wasteful the amount of money that gets spent on all these stadiums. But I also think it's wasteful to pay, you know, an actor or a rock star $20 million. So there's a lot of waste that goes on in the world. But at the end of the day, when the torch is lit for the next 17 days, you are seeing people who the beauty to me of the drama of the Olympics is people from all over the world that have been training in pools and on tracks and on fields in places in teeny-weeny little countries to the big, giant powerhouse countries, and they're on the same playing field competing against each other, and it's just they only have one chance. It's not like if you lose an NBA game, there's another game tomorrow. If you lose a baseball game, there's another game tomorrow. These athletes, there is no tomorrow for most of them. They're training for that one moment, a 10-second race. If you have a bad day, if you fall down like Simone Biles, the best gymnast in the world by far, but if she falls down, that's it. All of this training and you don't get a medal.
Right.
There is so much tension. There's
right.
so much drama.
And it shows us what the human body is capable of, what people can accomplish when they train. That is the spirit of the Olympics. Michelle, thank you so much. Michelle Kaufman is a sports writer for the Miami Herald. Matthew Futterman is a senior special writer on sports for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from New York. Thank you so much to both of you. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.